Okay.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Cultural Studies Podcast. My name is Toby Miller, and my guest today is...
Hello, I'm Aisha Durham. I am a professor of communication, media and communication at the University of South Florida in the United States.
Thank you so much for being with us, Prof. And I have to say, I've now done over 500 of these episodes, I discovered, and you have the professional equipment set up. It looks amazing. I was just saying to you when we were gossiping before recording, but I feel as I'm, talking to a mid-21st century radio studio denizen. It's amazing.
This is the media setup in our post-COVID world.
Yeah, beautiful. Well, I guess there are some good things about the horror of that. In any event, Prof, I wanted to begin by asking if you would share with us what are the things that are currently dynamizing, preoccupying, interesting, worrying you?
I think what has been on my mind of late, and it is something that I'm working through, is the broader concept of belonging. And I use belonging, and I know that sometimes this could be just a catch-all to mean just, anything. But in terms of not just, we can talk about political belonging in terms of citizenships, but we can also talk about belonging in terms of culture. And a lot of my work now that I'm in the kind of latter half of my career, I suspect, I am thinking and kind of doing some archival work and thinking about what do I mean when I say being a part of a community.
Yes.
And for me, that has not just cultural, but also these physical connections, literally to things. So a part of my work is right now, I'm interested in how people use belongings, as in personal possessions, to connect to a sense of belonging, whether that is cultural, ethnic, racial, religious. So how do they use these things in order to say something about who they are or from where whence they came? And this becomes important in terms of thinking about migration, thinking about refugees, first generation, second generation immigrants, or even those of us, I'm African American, who migration from different parts of rural to city, but also not having, growing up in a economic precarity, not having space to keep on or to hold on to stuff. So we have stories, but we also have these little trinkets that seem worthless to us, but they hold a kind of history. So in thinking about kind of migration and movement and connecting that to culture and ideas of kind of, again, that broader sense of citizenship, I'm thinking about what does it mean to belong and what are those things that we attach to ideas of belonging. And some could be very serious. In terms of I have one suitcase and this is all I can take, or I have the clothes on my back and this is all I can take, or I've had, I don't know, a cookbook that has lasted throughout generations. So I think that intrigues me because that tells me more about who you say you are than what you kind of possess in terms of how you kind of navigate the world, those little ordinary kind of mundane things.
And sometimes they can be very visible if you go to someone's house or you see them, like, say, a wedding ring or a pair of earrings or a car. A car can be a big example of that. And sometimes they're very private things that we're unlikely to see, I guess, right? They're the things you keep in your glory box or...
Yes.
The kind of toothpaste that you look for when you
Yes,
go to a new
yes.
place, right? It can be something very visible and something not so clear and apparent
Yes.
to others.
And I think I've spent, the last couple of years, I think everybody who knows me by now is sick of me talking about belonging. But before I even had to kind of work with the concept of that, I would literally ask people, about maybe a shirt. Maybe the ring is quite obvious. Some people have tattoos. It is almost like a way of
Is.
expressing oneself. But then again, I might ask about earrings. I might ask about anything that just seems very ordinary. And I usually get a story that is connected to place, that's connected to a people, a community. And it just, I'm fascinated by the layers of that, just with the actual thing. And I think some other researchers are working with that in terms of talking about materiality and the like. I came to this in talking about memory, because much of my work deals with representation. And when I talk about representation, I'm not always just talking about the kind of form or structure as we would do in kind of a semiotic or visual studies. I think when we talk about representation, we are really talking about memory. Representation and how it sticks. The stickiness of representation is how we make a experiential or kind of relationship with that thing or thing that we see or experience. That's how representation has meaning. So anytime we're talking about representation, we're really, in my mind, talking about memory.
And I think about that in terms of the campaigns around the world, but in many ways, I think driven by the example of African Americans and their allies, in terms of statues commemorating racism, the Civil War in the United States, colonialism, and so on. I was fortunate enough, in inverted commas, to be living in New Orleans when the Robert E. Lee Memorial in Lee's Circle was taken down, although, of course, it was done in the middle of the night to protect the workers. But I was there when there were, sons of the Confederacy with axes and whatnot, and their battle flags and all the rest of it against completely peaceful folks, right, in support of a
I
different
come
kind
from
of memory.
Virginia. Yes, I come from Virginia. And in Virginia, even in our educational system growing up, I think I went to just about every plantation in the southern part of Virginia where we never heard the stories and the lived experiences of those enslaved, but we were invited to take to participate in the kind of myth making in terms of the nation state. And in fact, it was only until I went to college in Richmond, Virginia, which used to be the capital of the Confederacy in the United States, where there was another Lee statue right in what they would call Monument Park, where you had Confederate generals right in the center of the university, where they would celebrate Lee, as in Robert E. Lee or Martin Luther King and Day, and they were on the same day. So you had somebody who was fighting for civil rights and broader democracy in terms of all people in the United States, and then a Confederate general. And so you would literally have people say, "I'm taking off Lee Day." And that was demonstrative to say that they were not celebrating Martin Luther King. And this is in the late 1990s. So we are now, in some ways, having a revisit of this. But you're right in terms of thinking about kind of memory making in terms of those statues. And that suggests that even in terms of something like memory, it is still imbued with power. Because in some ways, even in this moment with the erasure of DEI, or diversity, equity, and inclusion, or connections to race, and identity, there's a way in which we're asked to disremember or misremember history as a way of kind of shoring up a particular narrative about the United States. So that in terms of a spectacular thing is a part of memory, but even those kind of ordinary things connected to that.
And Prof, you grew up in a place that, in a sense, was imbued with this ethos of the Confederacy, along with, all very different stories, black stories. And now you're living somewhere that is the epicenter of the attack on critical race theory, the assault on, as you say, diversity, equity, inclusion. And this is coming at a time when you've dedicated quite a lot of your research in the recent past, at least that I've been able to find and make my way through, to intersectionality and some of the problems with, I guess one could say, a white perspective on intersectionality, and a white feminist perspective in particular. So this is a very long double question, not the one you're supposed to ask, right? Sorry. So the first thing is, I wonder if you could reflect on the current conjuncture in terms of the assault. Of course, it's not just in Florida, but it's also in Florida. But then perhaps leading off from that into this question of intersectionality.
Yeah, so I have had the pleasure or the displeasure, but I take them all as challenges because I say that I'm a person of the American South. My family is from different parts of the South. So the South feels very familiar and familial to me. And I'm based in Florida right now. Before coming to Florida, I was in Texas. And in Texas, there was a different kind of way of talking about diversity, much like what we are experiencing in Florida. And I would say that Texas actually helped to incubate some of the very ideas that are happening in Florida today. Before that, I was at the University of Georgia, and at the University of Georgia, the Confederate flag was still flying at the state capitol. So, and even on my drive to work right now in Tampa, Florida, there's a huge Confederate flag along the highway on the left-hand side and a huge white cross on the other side. So it's that ride to work tells me everything that I might need to know about the kind of climate
And it's not the moment when you want to get a flat tire.
Not necessarily, but it is very much the kind of making of what I would call this kind of new South. But in terms of intersectionality, I think what is happening, whether you're talking about the kind of assault, and I would say an attack in terms of anything that is promoting equity, anything that is challenging dominant power on the, I'm going to say the right, for lack of a better lack of a better term, on the right. It works to kind of ignore power inequity, but still needing that representation of racial difference. But it does not want to acknowledge the inequity that difference makes. So it's a kind of tokenized way of thinking about racial difference. But I will argue that there are ways in which the left, again, for the lack of a better term, also uses race, acknowledges power, but that power still becomes a hierarchical way in which whiteness still is on top. So when I think about intersectionality, it's been taking up in so many different ways. But when women of color and Black feminists conceived of intersectionality, it was as an analytic. It was a way of understanding power in the spaces in which different bodies are located along, again, different intersections of power. Today, how it comes to be talked about within the left is, you know, I can put any identity together and that makes me intersectional. And that's really not the working of intersectionality. It suggests that when we're talking about these different power formations, they're inextricable. And in order to understand the way in which power works, we would have to talk about how they could be constitutive of each other, or kind of embedded or informed or interdependent on one another, in order to have a full kind of rendering of how that power operates. So we cannot talk about, you know, patriarchy without talking about heteropatriarchy connected to capitalism. Like, it doesn't work, because the very kind of working of gender is informed by how we think about women's labor, women's value, and women as property. And we can expand that to talk about different groups. But intersectionality wants us to be able to bring those together. So on the right, I'll say, again, we're not even talking about power difference. We're just using the bodies in order to kind of shore up this idea of equality that does not exist. And on the left, we are talking about power, but we're only talking about power that still in some ways supports a white dominance. And so in that sense, Black women in particular, who have been the stewards of intersectionality, even in the academy, we're seen as raw material, and white theorists, then they get to theorize the raw material that Black theorists make. And this becomes a problem because, again, the very people who create the theory or the concept or the analytic are not seen as the people who are actually advancing the intellectual thought in the first place. So there are problems on both with both.
And I think this relates to some of your criticisms of attempts to historicize or periodize feminism, and specifically the use of the word wave with reference to US feminist history. I wonder if you could share with us a few points on that score.
Yeah, so the very way in which feminism is taught, particularly in terms of U.S. Feminism, is through these kind of markers of the waves. And as a teacher, I understand the utility in having something that students will be able to kind of flesh. So having that kind of chronology is useful. But if we start with the idea of thinking about, you know, from, you know, women's suffrage to equal rights, all the way to thinking about, again, things like intersectionality or even the fourth wave in terms of thinking about kind of the digital era, the idea of the wave itself, it really still centers on a particular whiteness and white womanhood. As when we're talking about suffrage, we still have women who are like, hey, what about me? You're talking about, you know, being like a man or even voting. Other people are talking about no genocide or I want to be free. So the wave model in and of itself, just by its construction, leaves out a whole host of people. By the time we get to what's called the third wave, which is where my work intersects, the third wave really recognizes what we've talked about before in terms of intersectionality, but it posits itself still within this white space. I'm learning from the women of color, from the quote unquote so-called second wave. Yet it is as if there are no contemporaries to the white women who are theorizing in this third wave. And so you have a whole group of women of color, Gwendolyn Pugh and others, who are saying, hey, we're here. We're actually using the work of people like Audre Lorde and the like. And we're using their work and we're creating this other space, not just in terms of the third wave, but what I would become a part of in terms of hip hop feminism. And hip hop feminism, in some ways, comes together as a response to a kind of whitewashing of the third wave, but also a feminism that is going to take seriously how we understand culture as a political space. So for women of color, and particularly young women of color, who don't have access to traditional forms of power, whether that be in terms of economic power, traditional forms of political power, or even military power. Mm-hmm. Culture becomes this site where Black women and women of young women of color wield so much influence. You cannot look at culture, even global culture today, without thinking about the ways in which Black girls and Black women have shaped and moved culture, just by language, style, music, anything. every kind of facet, especially when we're talking about a popular culture, even within a global diasporic space, Black girls and Black women are right there. So hip hop feminism recognizes culture as a kind of pivotal site in order not only to just, communicate something about ideas, but to mobilize and actually use that space to challenge those hierarchical or dominant systems of power. And from that space, we have these different movements, whether it's Black Lives Matter, whether it's Me Too, whether it's Mute R. Kelly, and the like, all coming from that generational cultural space.
And Prof, hip hop is one of your major themes. The books Home with Hip Hop Feminism and Homegirls Make Some Noise, a great title. I wonder if you could spell out a little bit. I know this sounds very basic, but as you know, we've got lots of folks outside the US. And although hip hop is a hugely international movement, depending on people's backgrounds, it might need a bit of explanation. But also, of course, its relationship to cultural politics.
Yeah, so hip hop is celebrating its 50th year. A lot of discussion has been about, the formation of hip hop itself from mainly New York first generation, second generation immigrants. So we rarely talk about the very formation of hip hop culture as being immigrant culture. That's important to know with both brown and black on youth. So that's important to kind of emphasize here because so often it is associated specifically with African Americans, and I want us to be clear. Sometimes African Americans and Black Americans, it is collapse and they're not collapsible. I still treat African American as an ethnic identity within a broad range of blackness in terms of its heterogeneity. But if I could talk about how I have understood hip hop, I rarely talk about hip hop in terms of cultural products. And even though I may analyze music videos, rap songs, looking at a performance of an MC, and usually that's how hip hop is talked about, whether it's talking about, break dancing or any kind of hip hop oriented dance, DJing or turntablism, MCing or rapping. When we are talking about those are kind of the practices, but also they're the package that we see that's disseminated, globally. But hip hop, in a sense, if I could, go from early conversations of how we understand culture, it's a way of life. And when I say that, my understanding of hip hop was not necessarily connected to just rap music. It was because I live in public housing or government funded housing on welfare. And it was what, three generations of us who had lived in this public housing community. And there was a way in which hip hop was a way of raising a class consciousness. And this was similar to how we would understand, the kids who were in the Northeast who were talking about the struggles in terms of a class consciousness as minoritized youth, ways in which they saw the police surveilling neighborhoods, the ways in which they saw schools being defunded. Again, we can think about how this is operating right now. The ways in which news media frame youth as always already criminalized. So when I heard rap, I heard experiences of my own lived reality in a Norfolk, Virginia public housing community. So when I think about hip hop, I'm thinking about what are the kinds of conversations and what are the conditions by which people, and particularly minoritized youth, articulating how they understand themselves within a particular class construct. And I think that class consciousness is what resonates, that move from, you know, the Northeast of the United States to all around the world, where the most fervent and politicized hip hop is really that challenge of power. So we might get sensationalized, you know, I'm twerking everywhere, not to say that twerking is not political, but we might see those iterations everywhere. But the kind of hip hop that resonates, moves, and moves people still is because of that class consciousness.
That's a fantastic explanation. Thank you so much. Oh, excuse me. I want to come back to your publications in a moment, but there was something you said almost en passant earlier that seemed quite important to me. When I was growing up, the idea of the New South in the United States was the idealized notion of Atlanta, where there would be black power in small p. There would be black enterprises, black politics, and a certain sense of community and freedom, essentially about the emergence of a black middle class. This was going to be the New South. You used this expression a few minutes ago. I think you're talking about a different New South.
Oh, it's a different New South. Maybe this is a new, maybe I'm talking about a new New South. And the reason why I'm saying New South, because there's a way in which even in popular media, in which we're now focusing so much of the ways in which the black, saying the black experience, but black experiences are represented are really in terms of the industrial North. Maybe we'll get the Midwest, like Chicago, Detroit, but we rarely get a Charlotte or an Atlanta or any spaces that are coming out of the South. And I think part of the televisual or even the cinematic move to seeing the complex lives of people in the South comes actually from the shift in music. It's rare to talk about any formation of new popular music emerging from the United States, or even in terms of the people who are coming from the Caribbean, but who are based in the United States, that is not connected to the South. So along with that kind of sonic shift, we also see this visual shift. However, in that space of this imagined, this new South, where they're supposed to be, you know, there are black people. And I would say there have always been black people. In fact, that was one of the main, you know, fears of plantation owners. Like, hey, they're outnumbering us. How do we stop these potential rebellions? So there have always been, you know, a sizable population of black people. It has not always translated into black power. In Atlanta, I mean, it's seen as the quote unquote Harlem of the South. It's seen as a different kind of space because you do have this kind of middle class representation. However, when we're looking at kind of broader formal politics, you still have black people who are really disenfranchised and do not hold that same kind of political power. So again, when I talk about the centrality of culture, then culture becomes important in order for us to think about those formal kinds of power, whether that's in terms of economic power or political power. But the New South in this, what I'm saying, the New South is a space where we can see the complexity of Black life, because in some ways, there's an understanding that we already know who African Americans are. There's a way in which there's a knowing of African Americans, like, oh, we already know this. But that is also a racial discourse that keeps African Americans in this kind of almost immovable position in order to talk about the kind of malleability, the flexibility, or even the heterogeneity of other communities. But that's a race discourse in and of itself. So the fact that we're seeing the kind of complex kind of relationships, not only in terms of thinking about, you know, Black families, but relationship to the land, relationship to other communities. I think in some ways it allows us to kind of rethink of what we imagine the South to be. Of course, it is racist. The whole United States is racist. So that's a given. But how do Black people kind of live with and live in and shape and make community within these spaces that we can see are very much in a space of backlash or blacklash against any Black progress, whether that be political, economic, or cultural?
Prof, in addition to your books and your articles in scholarly journals, you've also done quite a lot of work with the bourgeois media. You've been a very effective and powerful voice in a sense, mainstream media, but let's say liberal US media, right?
Yes.
I wonder if you could talk to us about that, and also talk to us about what it's like writing for that audience versus an academic one. And I preface this by saying that I actually found online an article you wrote when you were in college for the student newspaper.
Oh, wow.
So
Oh, wow.
I found, I mean, I'm sounding like I'm some great archivist. I just put your name into a search engine, and that was one of the things that came up. Anyway, I read it and I realized, good grief, this gal, this prof, could write journalistic copy when she was doing her undergrad. So I'm assuming it wasn't that huge a shift for you once you were a research professor to be able to write in that mode as again. So could you tell us about the shifting between those modes and some of the differences or similarities?
Yeah, I think part of my work has always been to democratize knowledge. And I think that some of the writers and researchers that resonate with me were always able to have these different audiences. Here, I'm reminded of Stuart Hall. I'm reminded of bell hooks and the like. So the idea that whatever I write, I want to be able to speak to different audiences. And when I was in high school, I was a high school correspondent for a daily newspaper, and I knew that I wanted to be a journalist. And the reason why I wanted to be a journalist, I said, because I wanted to right the wrongs of the ways in which news media portrayed people who looked like me.
Ida B. Wells.
Because,
That's an
yes,
idea when you
yes,
cite the work.
I am in the tradition of Ida B. Wells in that sense.
Yeah.
Yes. So in many of the writers that we even see in terms of hip-hop feminism, they are coming out of journalism themselves, either writing for newspapers or magazines. So that tradition was what I was going for before I had my internship at Time Magazine. And I said, oh, I'm in the space of, you know, again, kind of archiving and documenting culture, and we are like reproducing the same stereotypes. I'm going to be a professor. So I'm going to teach these media practitioners not to reproduce the same stereotypes. But in my research is not much different from that earlier kind of work, in the sense that I'm still trying to flesh what happens when that kind of mediated body or that representational symbolic body of Black women or Black people in general meet the lived experience. Like sometimes they come together, sometimes they clash, but I want to know what those moments, what happens in those moments. And from, you know, early writing, I was still writing about memory, writing about experiences and connecting that to broader representations. I can tell you in terms of, you know, talking to broader kind of media outlets, I'm invested in having that work translated. And I say translated because oftentimes, I mean, I have students who may not even read a book, read that book or articles, but if they see something or hear, you know, something within popular media, and I'm still calling that popular media within the kind of cultural study sense of the popular, It will invite them to go to look at that other source. And now I'm talking about students who are in college. So you would think that they would be reading our articles, but they're not necessarily reading those. But it is a part of I really still see myself as doing political work, and this is one of the spaces that I'm able to speak to different audiences. So whether it is I'm talking to legacy media or news media sources, or whether it's using different forms, I am very invested not only in writing kind of formal social scientific or even kind of text-based analysis that will be received in any number of journals. But also poetry, performance. These are also democratizing ways of presenting knowledge. Oftentimes we don't even think about, we think about what we might study. We might think about the approach that we might take. We rarely think about how we choose to represent it. And so form then becomes an important way to kind of disseminate that knowledge. And so from the news article to the blog, to speaking, to you right now, all of these are different ways to disseminate knowledge that has the potential to be a more democratizing form than the kind of standard monograph or a research article.
Now, speaking of this, you also had, from what I can tell, a significant role in the creation of the Smithsonian Anthology of Hip Hop and Rap. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about that experience.
I don't know if I had a significant role. I was honored to be a part of one of the advisors. So I was a part of looking at hundreds of songs to basically rank them in terms of talking about their significance. And this was a part of Smithsonian, and there was a huge collection, not only with CDs, but that can tell you in terms of how we're talking about technology, but CDs, but also essays and critical essays about the significance of artists, but also in terms of the songs themselves. But that was important, not only in terms of making sure that women were represented, because oftentimes in the discussion of hip hop, it doesn't matter if it is, 2024, we're still talking about women's contribution to a still largely masculinist way of talking about hip hop. But it was also important to think about the significance of hip hop that was not just germane to just the music genre itself, but talking about how it could kind of reverberate, if I could even say that term, how it could echo in these different areas, whether it's in terms of style, fashion, language, and the like.
And just to give some context for people, the Smithsonian Institution is this sort of massive entity, federal government entity, very important as a repository, an archive of knowledge. And this can include popular knowledge and unpopular knowledge.
Yeah, speaking of memory, it is a way of archiving US memory with actual artifacts and the like. So in terms of that, and if I could just talk about one memory, it was this really beautiful moment for me, because I remember one of the first times that I got on a bus. My mom packed some chicken and bread, and we went from Norfolk, Virginia to Washington, D.C. I was in elementary school, and I went to the Smithsonian. So the idea of this, little poor black girl going to the Smithsonian to see, like, the Capitol, and now to actually have, my name in a book, an exhibit as a part of the Smithsonian, it feels as if I, in some ways, was walking into something. It felt a little bigger, not just for me, but for my family and the people I represent. And plus, I was also kind of excited. My brother is a DJ and a producer. Much of what I know from hip hop comes from my brother. My uncle was also a DJ. I could not rap for my life, but I stuck to poetry, which is also just another form of rapping. But that also made me feel good to say that, Dick's Park. We are in the building.
Would you speak to us a little bit about you and poetry?
Yes, I think one of the ways in which I early on began to express myself was through poems. Poetry for me, if I could use the language of Audre Lorde, is a distillation of experience that you have to economize language to say exactly what you mean. And when I talk about poetry, it's not always in stanzas. Anything that I write, you could tell in one sentence that I'm still using the tools and techniques, whether it's alliteration, whether it's creating kind of sound with words or movement with words. What I write is meant to be said aloud, is meant to be experienced, even if it's not, formatted in terms of a stanza. My prose, I write still poetically. But poetry, for me, was my kind of entry point to thinking about Black feminism. Some of the very Black feminists who I admire are and were writers. I can recall, again, since we're talking about memory, the one moment when I had, a series of, little poems that I was working on, and my mom. She went with who I call my auntie. She went with her to see her daughter and her professor at Virginia Tech. Who knew at that time? My mom came back and she said, I met somebody named Nikki. I told her that you wrote poetry. And I was like, Nikki who? She says, Nikki Giovanni. I said, Nikki Giovanni? Why can't you tell me? She was like, I told her my daughter writes too. And I'm like, you told Nikki Giovanni that I write poetry? And she said, yeah, she told her, send her some. So I had a little word processor and I'm trying to type out my little poems. I'm in high school at this time to send Nikki Giovanni my poems and she writes back to me and hands a book to me, which I treasure this letter. But it was one of the ways in which, I had, again, talking about belongings, in my hand, kind of the connection with poetry. I feel the same way when I, hear and what I want to say, witness the words of people like Nikki Finney. And others. So poetry for me is this kind of portal to thinking about the ways in which Black women emote, feel, and experience the world in ways in which we are denied in other spaces. We are invited to be emotional, but only in service and to care of the kind of white public. Like we can be nurturing, we can be caring, not necessarily caring for ourselves. We can't be angry, or we'll fall into another a script. So the way in which poetry kind of allows Black women to be free, I found that most attractive when I was a child. And even as a communication scholar, kind of freeing up and carving space, so that becomes a representational form of knowledge. We still undervalue the different ways in which different forms can help us to articulate an understanding of culture. And I think poetry actually does some of that work for us.
Prof, I've got one more question for you, and then I'd like to throw it to you, lest there be things you'd like to add to what we've discussed. Does that sound okay as a means of concluding? So
Absolutely.
My last question, and this is your jackpot opportunity, is to ask you about one of the big things you use and you've drawn on in our conversation already, which is autoethnography, and also your argument that autoethnography is black. Can you share with us what autoethnography is for those who may not know, and in what sense it's black?
Autoethnography is in general terms is a writing of the self and culture. It's a writing of the self in relation to culture. And that's just the kind of standard definition of autoethnography. I treat autoethnography and that I is very important for me. And I think that I, if we're talking about autoethnography as black, I'm not using black necessarily in terms of an identity marker. In some sense, the very discussion of autoethnography as black is seen as a provocation in the same way in which Stuart Hall asked, what is this black in black cultural studies? Like what does black come to mean? And when I read the work of black people who are writing autoethnography, that I is never a singular I. And a part of the ways in which thinking about I and blackness is, you know, even if we can take the Rastafari way of thinking about I and I, it is a social I. It is an I that is always connected to another person. So it's never this kind of, you know, psychological individual I. It is a social I. And if we understand that I am telling my story, but my story is connected to the stories of these other people, then the autoethnography in some ways works as a kind of testimony. It works as a kind of bearing witness of my particular experience, but experience that is then connected to other people who are like me. So that for me is how we're talking about the kind of black in terms of autoethnography. Also, when we are talking about autoethnography as black, there is a way in which performance in terms of language, part of autoethnography is also it's the writing of culture. So it's the product of the narrative itself, but it's even the process of writing and rewriting. Because I have students all the time who are in the class and they're like, this is what happened. I'm just representing what actually happened. Well, you are a storyteller. And anytime we're dealing with language, we're already constructing, editing, we're already, you know, knee-deep in interpretation and construction. So there's never a representation of experience. So when we're, if we have that opportunity, and this is what happens with Black language and Black speech all the time, we look at language as malleable. We look at storytelling as malleable. And so that becomes a part of how we are even crafting the narrative in and of itself. That's one of the other ways in which I see a kind of way in which we're talking about autoethnography as Black, to think about the malleability of language, and it's not a representation of reality. And then that other aspect, especially when we're talking about critical autoethnography, is that nobody is telling their experience for experience sake. Now, that's the distinction. Other people may do other kinds of autoethnography, but if we're talking about autoethnography as Black, that it is used in order to raise awareness about a particular experience or condition. So it is not catharsis. So I'm just telling my story because I need to tell my story, but I'm telling my story so now that you know, and if you walk away from this story without being, as Sonini Madison would say, incited to do something, then I, as an autoethnographer, have not done my job. Because the work of the story is to incite, to raise awareness and to move you to act. And so, again, the malleability of language, the idea of addressing power, but also thinking about the I as a social I are ways in which I think about autoethnography as Black.
And Prof, we've got about 5 minutes left, so I'm hoping that maybe there's time still for you to add anything in conclusion that I haven't asked you about, and I might have, should have, could have.
Well, I just knew that you were going to ask me about something connected to Beyonce. And I say that because Cowboy Carter, has just come out, and I just knew. I said maybe I should listen to the album before our interview because there will be a question and I will not know how to react. I have not listened to the album yet because I think everybody in some ways has some opinion and I wanted to sit with it myself. I can tell you from early on, I was not necessarily one of the people who is just rooting for Beyoncé Destiny's Child because the way in which I saw class being a representative. I suggested, and I still hold to this day, Beyoncé has a way of performing working class, but she doesn't have to be accountable for the performances of her working class representation, whether it's her wearing a grill in her mouth, her wearing claw fingernails, all of these things in which everyday ordinary Black women, you could be fired from your job, you could not be employed, you could be suspended from school, these very ways. So there are still ways from early on where I said, I like her, but I also want us to have a careful critique of the way in which class is being offered up. And there are ways in which we talk about racial representations without accounting for these very class distinctions that I think are still incredibly important. Now, I will admit, post Lemonade, completely different assessment. And I think along with, and I say along with her kind of development as an artist, and I would say just her being a grown Black woman, I also, developed and became, I grew in my own kind of scholarly appreciation of the ways in which she has had to navigate this space. But I hope to have something more substantial to say about Beyonce, but I can tell you at this point, I used to tell people I think I need to pay her because half of the discussion that I've ever had has been about Beyonce and her body. And I said, oh no, I think I'm going to be responsible for talking about Beyonce again. But thank goodness. I didn't have that, but I brought it on myself by bringing it up anyway. But I can tell you that perhaps that the album, just by the visual alone and the early tracks that have been out, are rich for scholarly discussion about belonging, about cultural and political citizenship, and about even the marker of American music, which there's no way of talking about American music, any genre, without talking about the contribution of African Americans to develop, create, and basically make American music and American popular culture writ large.
Prof. Aisha Durham, thank you so much for your contributions in general, but especially for doing me the privilege of being involved today. It's been really great, and I'm extremely grateful.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.